From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We all know how wrong most political polls got the 2016 presidential election. That trend seems to be continuing with midterm primary races. Pollsters are tremendously challenged in this era of unanswered phones. A candidate's appeal to a select demographic also affects who turns out. How do polls project that factor? We'll find out right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCalGas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, if you have friends or family members along the southeastern U.S. coast, even inland, I'm sure you're concerned reaching out to those folks where evacuations already underway in advance of Hurricane Florence, now a Category 4. NPR News will keep you up to date, and on Air Talk we'll have special live coverage as well as Florence bears down on the southeast, particularly Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. I saw even in D.C., the mayor has declared a state of emergency in advance of the arrival because of the heavy rain that the nation's capital is expecting. Coming up later on Air Talk, the ongoing challenge of figuring out who pays on a date. Does gender play a role? Should it? What about who makes more money? We'll find out how singles negotiate restaurant dates later this hour. First, with the midterm elections just 2 months away, state and district political polls will receive more and more attention. But the challenges to accurate polling are many. We saw that during the 2016 presidential election, and we've sure seen it this year in congressional and gubernatorial primaries. Well, let's look at how pollsters are adapting to this era of unanswered phones and iffy turnout projections. With us, the gentleman who founded the USCLA Times statewide political poll, the Dornsife poll, Dan Schnur. He's professor of political science at UC Berkeley and the SC Annenberg School for Communication. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Larry, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, your Dornsife poll was arguably the most successful at predicting the presidential race, where others failed. But what are the ways that pollsters are trying to adapt to the challenges now of connecting with people?
Well, I should say this, that while it's worth noting that in 2016, the USCLA Times poll was one of the very few polls in the country that forecast a Trump victory. I should say, with all appropriate humility for me and the people who worked on the poll, is the poll was not ultimately accurate in that Donald Trump, as all of your listeners know, did not win the popular vote. That said, and obviously a poll measures popular votes, not electoral votes. That said, I think that poll was a very helpful one, because if you think about it, public opinion surveys are not designed necessarily to predict outcomes, but rather to give us better insight into why voters think and make decisions that they do. And I should give tremendous credit to the team over at the Center for Economic and Social Research at USC, the CSER, which is my favorite in academia, because they devised this a radically different approach during the 2012 campaign between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama that they convinced me to apply to the SC Times poll in 2016. What they did, and I'll be quick, they devised a method that instead of measuring just voter preference, do you prefer candidate A or candidate B, Clinton or Trump, Smith or Jones, instead what they came up with was a way to measure voter intensity. And what they did is instead of saying you're going to vote for Clinton or Trump, is instead ask two other questions. One, on a scale of 0 to 100, how certain are you of your vote for your preferred candidate? And on a scale of 0 to 100, how likely are you to vote? And what we found, just as most of the rest of the world saw in November of 2016, is that while more respondents preferred Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump, Trump supporters were much more motivated and much more intense in their support than Clinton's, and that's obviously what played out on election day.
Well, and this is something that political reporters, in speaking with them during the campaign leading up to the election, kept talking about. Those that would go to Trump rallies, those that would go to Clinton rallies, spoke consistently about this passion difference, and were musing about how that would factor in. So, was yours the only major poll that took that into account?
It was the only one I know of. Now, major poll, of course, is a relative term. And while the people at Caesar deserve a great amount of credit for their innovation, I don't know that others hadn't been making progress along similar lines. But what's worth noting is, in addition to identifying the intensity of Trump supporters, there was also a potential problem that emerged in that poll, which, from what I understand, they've been trying to address since then. And the reason that it showed Trump winning the popular vote when that wasn't the case is because the poll had a much more difficult time reaching rural voters as opposed to urbanites. And, of course, that was a key to Trump's success, is turning out voters from less populated areas. So if it wasn't absolutely unique, though, it was one of a small number of polls that that approached the question in this way.
We're talking with Dan Schnur, who's professor at UC Berkeley, as well as USC's Annenberg School. And his work at USC, he founded the SC LA Times statewide political poll. Also with us, Douglas Rivers, Stanford University professor of political science, and he's the president and CEO of YouGov Polemetrics, a global public opinion polling and data company. Professor Rivers, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here.
We've seen some real gaps between polling in these primary races around the country and the actual results, where we have seen more progressive candidates who've prevailed against traditional Democrats, longtime office holders. And it would seem one of the challenges is figuring out who's really going to turn out and how strong the appeal of a less traditional candidate is. How do polls try and solve that problem?
Well, there are two approaches. Most media polls ask voters how likely they are to vote. And the problem with that is that too many people tell you that they're likely to vote. Quite common to get over 90% of the people telling you they're definitely going to vote, even though turnout in this midterm is going to be more like 40%. Many campaign polls, which are done off of voter lists, use past propensity to vote. The problem with that is if the patterns change between a pair of elections, you can get the wrong electorate that way. So this is an active area where people are trying to improve the quality of predictions of who votes and who doesn't.
And is that a solvable issue? I mean, particularly in primaries where you don't have clear party affiliation as a guide.
Right. So primaries are harder than general elections. State and local elections are harder than national elections. And the difficulty in each of these is you have less good an idea of what the electorate's going to look like. Particularly in a primary where you don't have a predictor like party registration that will sort out lots of problems of bias samples, it's much more difficult to get those right.
So if you have segments of the electorate that haven't typically turned out for midterm primaries in the past, but turn out and bring about a victory for, let's say, more progressive candidate, does that then change the mix when you're looking at who you're reaching out to for the general election poll?
Well, we have methodologies for selecting samples, and we generally stick with those. I found that trying to make ad hoc adjustments is a good opportunity to shoot yourself in the foot.
All right. We're talking with Douglas Rivers, Stanford University, Dan Schnur, UC Berkeley, and SC Annenberg School. If you have questions for them about polling and the challenges in trying to get a handle on midterm election results, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dan, same question for you about, you know, if you get people turning out in a midterm primary that you didn't anticipate were going to be voting, can you count on those individuals turning out to support their candidate in November?
Well, Professor Rivers is right. You know, making midstream adjustments is always somewhat risky. That said, the key to a successful poll is trying to measure motivation. And as Professor Rivers correctly pointed out, historically the way that's been done is either by asking people how likely they are to vote, and when you give them a binary choice of yes or no, like everybody gives to charity, everyone's kind to their mother.
Yeah.
On election day. So the 0 to 100 scale that the SC poll used was designed to track a little bit more precisely those trends. And when you could compare the numbers of Trump supporters saying that they were likely to vote in the 80s and 90s, whereas Clinton supporters were likely to vote in the 50s and 60s, we were able to break through that a little bit. The other way historically that you've measured likely voter turnout is in past elections. And once again, this is something that the folks at CSER, the Center for Economic and Social Research, did very effectively. In 2012, they saw that young voters and minority voters were much more likely to turn out than they had in previous elections. So they boosted that aspect of the poll. And in 2016, as we were talking about a few minutes ago, they saw that white, rural, and working class voters were more, who had not turned out for Mitt Romney or John McCain, were more likely to turn out. So to circle back all the way around, even though you don't want to switch tactics in the middle of an election, if you see an unusually high turnout in a primary from a particular demographic group, that's usually a pretty good clue that that group is more motivated than they had been in the past, the way younger and minority voters were in 2012, the way older working class and rural voters were in 16. And generally the people who watch these things say that particularly in a House race, for example, if you simply add up the votes of all the Republican candidates in the primary and add up all the votes of the Democratic candidate, you get a pretty good indicator on what the general election is going to look like, because it does take that motivation level into account.
All right, Dan. Also, just as a practical matter, how do you connect with people you're surveying, given people don't answer phones much anymore? Online polls can have their own challenges to getting representative samples. So how do you get around that obstacle?
Well, first of all, this is as good a time as any to make sure that your listeners understand that while I was very proud of my work on the SC Times poll over the years, I'm no longer involved in it. But one of the things we started to do at SC, something that the Times was originally not comfortable with and ultimately came around to, was much more aggressive online polling. And over the years, the technology has progressed to the degree, and I'd be very interested in hearing Professor Rivers' thoughts on this, that while it's not absolutely reliable, of course, a lot of the early self-selection bugs have been worked out. And in particular, one of the real advantages of online polling is that you're more likely to get a respondent to tell you the truth. In other words, if you call someone on the phone and you actually get through to them, even if they've never met you, even if they're never going to see you face-to-face in your life, in their lives, they're still likely to tell you what they think you want to hear. And years ago in California, some of your older listeners will remember, they called this the Bradley effect. A lot of voters told pollsters that they were going to vote for Tom Bradley to become the first African-American governor of California back in the early 1980s because they thought that's what they should say. And over the years, that particular cohort has diminished. But generally, you find voters who are contacted by pollsters who will tell them on the phone what they want to hear. Online, on the other hand, it's not even a voice. And so what we found is that a voter who is seriously considering a vote for Trump was much more likely to indicate that on an online survey than on a phone poll.
That's fascinating. Hey, Tony has a question on the page. Why isn't polling for the presidential race specifically done on an electoral college basis? Is that too expensive?
It is too expensive.
It is.
Essentially, what you'd be doing is you'd be taking 50 individual state polls and then adding up the electoral votes from each one. But even if there's not one single entity around the country that's polling in all 50 states with a significant enough level of responses, the people who watch a presidential campaign most closely pay more attention to state-by-state polling than they do to national polls for just that reason. So even if it means relying on the UC Berkeley or the Public Policy Institute of California poll here in California, or the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel poll in Wisconsin, or the Miami Herald poll in Florida, looking at those state-by-state results allows an observer to get a much better sense of the likely outcome of the election than looking at national poll numbers.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. We're very quickly out of time. Dan Schnur, UC Berkeley and SC Annenberg School of Communication professor and founder of the USCLA Times statewide political poll, as he mentioned, no longer affiliated with it. Douglas Rivers of Stanford University, like Dan, political scientist. He's the president of YouGov Polymetrics Global Opinion, Public Opinion Polling. Coming up on Air Talk in just 1 minute, it's the season for the college rankings. We'll talk about the different methodologies that are used, as well as the limitations of attempting to rank universities against one another. It's Air Talk on KPCC. U.S. News and World Report just put out its 2019 list of college rankings. Notably for Angelenos, UCLA ranked as the country's top public university. Other annual college rankings put out by Forbes, the Wall Street Journal, and the Princeton Review. They often highlight the same schools, but they're often in a little bit of different orders. And they can use widely different metrics and methodologies for ranking the universities and colleges. With that in mind, we decided to check in with a couple of folks who are responsible for the rankings at their publications, and also to talk about what the shortcomings are of those lists as well. With us from Forbes magazine, assistant editor Carter Coudrier. Carter, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you share with us, just from your perspective, how the methodologies different publications use, how do they differ in what areas?
Sure. So the variety of different college rankings, like you said, often highlight the same schools, but for different reasons. The hallmark ranking is the U.S. News and World Report ranking, which looks at a variety of different metrics, some of which include what we define as input metrics, SAT scores, reputation, acceptance rates of schools. A lot of places look at endowment as a representation of how well a university can, you know, fund advancements in students' education. What we look at Forbes and what a couple other publications look at is purely output metrics. That's our mantra, outputs over inputs. We look at the effect that a university has on a student and just the student throughout their time there. Stuff like consumer experience, which we use survey data for that from one of our partners, Niche. We use retention rate for that to indicate that if a student's sticking around, they think it's, at the very least, a fine educational environment. And then the success metrics such as salary, such as going on to become a leader in your field, such as going on to procure a PhD in your field, trying to capture what success looks like in a variety of fields, the high-paying ones, the low-paying ones, the academic ones, the not-so-academic ones. Those would really be the major differences that I see between the buckets, the input ones versus the output.
Yeah. Well, can you give me a general idea with your list at Forbes, what percentage of it generally is based on current student experience and survey versus after graduation salary and other outcomes?
Sure. So the student experience metric is 20%. That is that meld of the niche data and the retention rate. In terms of what students go on to do, the success side of things is 35%. That's a blend of alumni salary, which we pool data from College Scorecard, which is the U.S. government's database of salary and other results for debt recipients, federal loan debt recipients, and then the American Leaders List, which we, which is something that we compile to capture leaders in a variety of fields, partially just keeping Forbes' mantra of leadership,
mm-hmm.
so partly to make sure that we're not leaving less high-paying fields by the wayside. And then we also look, in addition to that 35%, we look at academic success, not just career success. That would be
advanced degrees.
Want to earn PhDs and high awards such as the Fulbright or Truman scholarships.
And sort of state the obvious, it's important then for prospective students and their families to look at how important these issues are. I mean, for example, do they want to be in something where they're a leader, or how important is salary compared to other senses of career fulfillment, those sorts of things? I understand Forbes has a specific focus that you're looking at, but that wouldn't necessarily apply to all prospective college students.
You're completely correct. I think what's important for the prospective college student to know is that no college ranking is going to completely satisfy what their needs are, because we're trying to generalize what hundreds of thousands of students in America want out of their higher education experience. But at the end of the day, what I want is different than what our reader wants, and what Forbes may value institutionally, which I've gone through what our methodology is made up of, might not necessarily apply to everybody. So it's important that college rankings are taken as a supplement to the student admissions experience and not the be-all, end-all of it, which is unfortunately not the case for some students. But it is meant as a supplement. And we think we have a valuable one, but that just might not be the case for everybody.
We're talking with Carter Coudrier. He's assistant editor at Forbes. One of his projects is Forbes' annual top college rankings. They came out with their list just a couple of weeks ago. Also with me is Robert Franek, who is the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. Their Best Colleges 2019 is due for release in just about another week or so here. Robert, thank you for being with us.
Larry, good to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
So just real quickly, how would you differentiate your criteria from Forbes and U.S. News?
A couple of ways, and I think Carter kind of hit it on the head of some of the different kinds of rankings. I think the easiest way to understand our rankings at Princeton Review compared to others is that our best colleges rankings, and they did come out just a couple weeks before, August 7th was the date.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I had the wrong date.
That's okay. It's okay. It's based 100% on the opinion of current college students. So the surveys of 138,000 current college students from the 384 schools in the book drive all of the 62 different top 20 ranking lists in the book, as well as the narrative. So it's not the opinion of myself or our core team of editors at the Princeton Review. We go directly to whom we would consider college experts of their own experience, and those are current college students. So many other rankings, U.S. News specifically, will base their rankings, both national as well as regional, on quantitative metrics only. Now, we collect those things, as Carter and his team do at Forbes, but we choose 100% based on student opinion in that Best Colleges book. And then we have some other ranking lists in a book that I do called Colleges That Pay You Back, which is a mixture of quantitative and qualitative.
All right. And now with the Forbes list, they rank sort of everything, if I recall correctly, alongside each other. So you got smaller liberal arts schools, big research universities. They're kind of all in the same mix. You do a lot of slicing and dicing at Princeton?
We do. However, when the ranking lists come out, and again, there are 62 different top 20 ranking lists, they are small publics or small privates next to large publics, next to research institutions, next to technical schools. And that's very intentional on our part at Princeton Review. I want to make sure that students are finding sort of a school that's going to be the best fit for them, and that's an academic fit, campus culture fit, financial aid fit, career services fit, all the things that we've been chatting about already. It's so important for students to have during the college research process. And that's the information I feel like we're providing for them.
Hey, Robert, what have you seen as the biggest shift over the years you've been doing this, and what current students tell you is their biggest concern or perhaps a desire, something they're looking for that shifted?
Yeah, and I think this shift has happened, and I so appreciate the question. Over the last, call it 5 or 6 years, we've been doing a survey now for 10 years at Princeton Review called College Hopes and Worries, asking college-bound students and their parents what their biggest worries are and their biggest hopes are around the college process. Biggest worry, and this is 3 years running now, is the amount of debt that students are going to incur to pay for college. So we know the specter and the weight that college costs and navigating the financial aid process has on students and parents. Now, I've been a teacher forever, so I mean, what I know is that when students are not confident and their parents are not confident and they're scared around the process, then they're probably going to make avoidable mistakes. And that's what we're trying to combat. You know, give them as much information about financial aid. There are a ton of love letter schools out there that can supply great financial aid as well as great return on your investment. I think these are the biggest things that students are now focused on during the college research process, and I applaud it.
We're talking with the Princeton Review's editor-in-chief, Robert Franek, joining us on Air Talk. Also with us, data scientist Kathy O'Neill. She's the CEO of her firm Orca, which is O'Neill Risk Consulting and Algorithmic Auditing. It's based in New York. She's also author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy O'Neill, thank you very much for joining us. What are your concerns about these rankings?
Well, I think my biggest concern is just the trust that it engenders in all of us. Speaking as a mother whose oldest son, I have three sons, but my oldest just started college. We have, you know, an enormous amount of fear and uncertainty, and we're, as humans, uncomfortable with uncertainty, and we want an authority to tell us what the right thing is to do. And these lists give us that sense of trust. And I'm not convinced, for the most part, that it's warranted. There's lots of different approaches to this, but I would argue that, you know, it focuses too much on elite schools and doesn't give that much for those of us with kids that are good students but not elite students. It focuses, if you're talking about outputs, it focuses much more on schools that have engineering programs that all the kids who graduate finish with, you know, very fancy jobs at the end of it. What it really doesn't do, what it's blind to, typically, and I know this is not the fault of your guest, but just the fact about doing data science, is that it doesn't really get at the things that are difficult to quantify about a college experience. And so it necessarily, because you are quantifying things, talks about things like your feelings as a student or how much money you make afterwards or how fancy this college is relative to other colleges in terms of reputation. It doesn't ask the question of, you know, does this college, you know, expand you as a human, which is ultimately what parents and students will be caring about when they're deciding where to go.
You know, and I think one of the things, and you're sort of speaking to this issue, is how different students are from each other, and whether it's a particular program or the faculty associated with a particular program at a college or university, those are so highly variable, particularly if you're looking at a big research university. It's so many things under one umbrella to try and characterize the totality of that, which has tens of thousands of students and thousands of faculty and staff members. It's hard because the student's experience, depending on the program and who they have for professor, is going to be widely variable.
Absolutely. I mean, you just nailed it on the head. I mean, these lists, as well thought out as they are limited because they're not tailored to my child. If my child likes, you know, cities, doesn't like rural settings, if my child likes one-on-one attention, if my child wants to become an economist versus a playwright, These are very specific details that you and your children know about colleges that the lists are never going to know. Now, theoretically, you could have a system whereby a long list of questions are asked, and the parents and the students fill them out, and they get a tailored list. And I think that would be better than just a straight-up list that is already formulated for us, like a ranking for you. And I think we're headed that way just simply because it's not just the U.S. News and World Report model anymore. We have more than one. We have quite a few. But ultimately, it's, you know, even when we have that, there's going to be this certain unquantifiable something that will never actually be harnessed.
And ideally, and I know many, many kids don't have access to this, but ideally you would have, you know, such highly customized college counseling from highly experienced and research, knowledgeable counselors that they would help students and families with that process. But I know for many students, they're just at their public schools, they simply don't have that degree of resources available. Kathy O'Neill, thank you for being with us. Robert Franek, The Princeton Review, Carter Coudrier, Forbes. I want to thank you all for being with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, it's complicated. Who should pay for dates, particularly early on? Is it the person who issues the invitation should pick up the bill? Should the two people split the bill the first time out? Should gender enter into it at all, or the income level of the two people? We'll hear from you right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. I was so enjoying a recent Wall Street Journal article titled "Who Pays on a Date?" That's still a complicated question, written by Elizabeth Bernstein. And it just had all kinds of fun anecdotes about the challenges of figuring out that sort of dance around who picks up the check, particularly for a first or second date when people are just sort of getting to know each other over a meal. And it looked back at a survey that was done in the open access academic journal Sage Open. The survey came out 3 years ago, but it was a large sample, 17,000 people, single men and women responded to this. And 76% of men said they feel guilty if they don't pay on a date. Yet 64% of men believed women should contribute to the bill. Nearly half of the men surveyed said they would stop dating a woman who never pays. 40% of women said they were bothered if a man wouldn't accept an offer to pay. Nearly 40% wished men would reject their offers. And 44% said they were bothered when men expected them to help pay. So you see the challenge right here in navigating this whole issue. So my question for you is, if you're a single Air Talk listener, how do you handle that first and second meal? Is it the person that invites the other person out for a date at a restaurant that should pick up the tab the first time? Be honest, do you think gender does factor into this? Is there an expectation that a man should pay, particularly on the first date? If a woman offers to pay, should the man accept that, at least a portion of the bill? Do you prefer splitting the bill on the first date? Does that keep it cleaner? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. And I wonder if this is something even discussed prior to going out on that restaurant date, or if you feel like that would be tacky and you deal with it, actually on site at the restaurant. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me, lecturer in philosophy and theology at Boston College. She also lectures on dating, Carrie Cronin. Carrie, thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So, have you seen other surveys on this that also indicate a lot of contradictory results?
I haven't. This was a great survey, and none of it surprised me. I think your point is so well taken. It's really confusing, and people find themselves in these sort of crazy situations where we just don't know what any of these dating practices mean anymore.
And do you have advice on particularly on a first date? Do you think it should be the person who asks out, or is it easier to for me, for example, splitting the check on a first date feels a little clinical. It makes it feel like a business lunch or something. And I don't know that for me, when I was dating, if I invited someone out for a lunch or dinner date, I would pick up the check. But what do you think?
Right. So when I have kind of stumbled into this strange situation where I advise my students to go on dates. In fact, I give it as an extra credit assignment in a class of mine. And over the years, I've talked to many students about these kinds of things and young adults. And what I have found is they're all as confused as we are about this. And when you're on a different gender date and there's that question about should a man pay and what does it mean if he pays? Does he feel like I owe him something? It creates all of these sort of difficult signals and misreading of signals. And so I often say to students, look, if you ask someone on a date, you should pay. I'm opposed to splitting the bill because for me that, as you say, that does feel like, well, we're just two people who've arrived at the same
right.
time and we're getting coffee standing next to each other. And friends split the bill, you know, but this is something different. It signals that there's something a little more than just an ordinary event going on. And it gives a person a chance to show their generosity and their care and concern for another person. So paying for a date is a really important thing to do, but we get pretty muddled about who should pay and what it means.
Yeah, and then if one individual moves to pick up the check, should the other just pro forma, you know, reach for a wallet to contribute toward the bill just as a symbol, even if they know it's not going to be accepted by the person picking up the bill?
Sure, sure. So when I talk to my students about this, I say, this is the bill paying dance. You have to learn this dance, right? When the bill comes, or, you know, the person who asked should not aggressively reach for it, you know, but should very clearly sort of take the bill. And then the other person should say, no, oh, can I help with that? Or can I leave the tip? That's a way of showing that you're a person who's grateful. You can, just as the person who's paying or who, you know, moves to pay the bill is showing, you know, I want to treat you nicely. I want to show my generosity. The other person should show their gratitude, you know, and that they're not just there expecting or assuming that somebody's going to pay for them. So there's a dance. You're supposed to respond, no, I'd like to help with this. And then the other person says, no, I'd like to get it. You can get it next time.
Yeah.
And then you say thank you. So there's a back and forth that's supposed to happen. But unfortunately, what has happened is people come to this with a whole set of assumptions and expectations and maybe even biases that they don't even know they're bringing to the table. And then things are getting worked out in an unspoken way so that sometimes you go away from the date thinking, wow, that person sort of aggressively grabbed the bill. And now, you know, and I didn't like that. Or that person didn't even offer to help me with the bill. And I didn't like that.
Carrie, hold that thought because I want to bring some listeners into our conversation. Carrie Cronin joining us on Air Talk. Tina, you know, Liso Viejo, how do you handle this when you go on a restaurant date?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I come at it at a more anthropological stance. And I think, you know, biologically, women are programmed to seek a mate who's a provider. So I think when you go on a date and a man, you know, foots the bill, it shows that he has the ability to take care of you, I guess, in the long haul. And I think it's really important to make that impression on a woman. And to add another layer to it, I am Persian, I'm Middle Eastern, and culturally, it's a whole, you know, set of sub-rules, too. And for us, a man basically has to pay the bill. It's the manly thing to do. And I cannot even imagine a woman paying the bill, you know, especially on the first or second date.
Tina, have you gone out with non-Persian guys who have had different expectation? Has that been an issue with any dates you've had?
Yes. And as bad as this sounds, it's kind of turned me off from seeing them again. And I don't know if it's because, you know, my culture has such a grasp on me or if it's something that, as I said, as a woman, I'm kind of biologically programmed to expect a man to demonstrate his ability to provide. Um, But yeah, it's had a huge effect on whether or not I see the person for a second time or not.
Tina, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for sharing that with us, also giving a cultural perspective to that. Carrie Cronin, just real briefly, you know, it's an interesting point she raises, because I suppose you could make the argument that historically, as part of our evolution, there was the need for physical protection from a man. So this is, you know, sort of symbolic of our early human origins. Even in this era where, you know, more women graduate from college from men, your thoughts about how this plays out?
This is such a great point, and I'm so glad Tina brought this up. I often say, you know, the dating scripts, you know, these very sort of these practices that have persisted are kind of deteriorated now. And so it's leaving us, because we don't have these scripts, we are actually interpreting things through our own sort of understandings. And maybe some of those, many of those might be really shaped by our cultural backgrounds. But because we don't talk about it, we don't have scripts that are working. We have only, we sort of don't have any functioning scripts for dating. We end up with these meanings and values that are just kind of residues of these sort of cultural assumptions or assumptions about what it means to be a man or a woman and what it means to be a provider or what it means to be generous. And so because of that, because we're not really operating relative to a set script, there's all kinds of feelings that we have associated with these meanings and values, but we're not always even articulating them to ourselves.
Yeah. Tina, really appreciate the call. Alex, who's a woman in Los Feliz, says, I know I'm going to sound anti-feminist, but I think men should pay on the first few dates. Women spend so much more money on makeup, hair, clothing, other grooming activities due to societal pressure. Even our deodorants cost more. Plus, men statistically earn more money. This is the way it balances out. That's Alex in Los Feliz. We'll continue our conversation with Carrie Cronin. She lectures at Boston College and lectures college students around the country about the protocols of dating, particularly in this era when it's not so clear if there are any protocols. We'll continue with more of your calls in 1 minute. I was looking at this Sage Open study about dating expectations of single men and women, and this is a total aside, but I have to say it's just is disturbing to me. 16% of the male respondents said they expect sex if they paid for the date. What, 16% hold that view? What? It's just incomprehensible to me how that somehow entitles someone to that expectation. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Laura in Woodland Hills. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
So what's your experience? Restaurant dates, how do you prefer to handle the payment?
Sure. So I've been dating my boyfriend for about a year, and I was the one who asked him out first, which I found very empowering. And so on that first date, I decided to pick up the bill, and we sort of did have that back and forth about, you know, who pays the tip, who pays the bill. I ended up taking responsibility, and now we sort of try to share that financially, just to sort of take the gender out of it. I really appreciate having that conversation with him.
And when you went on the first date, which you asked him out, did he seem to have any hesitation about your picking up the tab?
Sure. Yeah, we had a conversation about it, and I kind of went in with the understanding that you know, I had asked him out, so that was something that I sort of socially took on.
Yeah.
Sort of like an expectation of myself that I just sort of went in prepared to offer that I should pay.
Yeah, I think that's great. Real quickly, Carrie Cronin, what do you think, since she's the one who asked that she'd pick up the bill first time?
I think that's fantastic. And what's crucial there is that Well, two things are crucial. I think number one is that she initiated a conversation about it, which is great. And number two, she was really honest with herself about what that was going to mean. Because sometimes I talk to women and they say, well, I wanted to pay the bill because I'm wary, you know, about that 16% of guys who expect something, or I'm liberated and I want to be able to pay. But then later, they often have feelings about, you know, feelings that are sort of ambivalent about themselves. You know, actually, I wanted him to pay, or I think less of him because he didn't insist on paying. So we have to be really honest with ourselves about what our beliefs are about this. And that can take a little more work than we think ahead of time. But I love this last caller's idea of being honest with yourself and then having the conversation up front.
All right. Let's talk with Crystal in Long Beach. You're on Air Talk.
Hi there. So I wanted to make a comment that I like the conversation of who gets to pay on the first date. I think it sets a tone and it gets to understand like what the expectations are in their relationship. So I get usually very offended when I hear a man say that they have to pay on the first date, because it means that they expect that they'll be the breadwinner, that they're going to make the money, and that I am not allowed to be successful and pay for things for them.
So even if he's the one who invited you out, and even if he said, well, you can pick it up next time, would that still offend you?
I think that if you set the tone like, hey, yeah, you can get this next time, that shows equality in the relationship, that they're okay with kind of moving the bill back and forth. But if they say they want to pay and they don't offer for me to pay the next time, I get very offended by that.
And yeah.
I feel like I'm roped in. I have to follow suit with that next date.
Sounds like you see that as a power play, kind of.
Absolutely. I've never been a fan of those type of relationships.
Crystal, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for sharing your perspective. Bradley in Santa Monica, I understand you're a gay man. How does this play out in your dating?
Usually, I just try to avoid awkward situations, so I try to keep things a little lower pressure, at least for the first date. So we usually probably go to, like, a fast casual place instead. So you order separately so you can both pay for yourself, so you don't have that weird thing about splitting and, like, oh, you paid more, you had a more expensive meal. And that just kind of helps things avoid any, like, real relationship questions early on, because I just want to see if I like this person in the first place.
Yeah. So the first date is just kind of the getting to know, and you don't feel like that takes away any sort of potential romantic feel of the night, or that you don't feel that intrudes by having separate checks.
Usually not, because usually it's also like lunch dates and stuff, or mm-hmm. like just getting a coffee. Just because, once again, I don't like commitment sometimes, so. Good to go in slow.
All right. Bradley, thanks so much. Appreciate you sharing your experience. Let's talk with Mike in Burbank. Mike, short on time, real quickly, how does this play out in your dating?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, with the world of Tinder and all these other different things of, you know, dating, it can get a little murky and weird. However, in those worlds, a lot of dating is just drinks nowadays. You're not actually going to sit down at a restaurant. But you're getting drinks and maybe an appetizer. And in those cases, I think the guy should always pay. If it is a sit-down dinner, the first date, I think the guy should also pay, no matter who asked.
Really? Even if the woman asks, you think the man should pick up that first restaurant bill?
I think so. Of course, I'm a little old school. I was raised Italian, and that's how, you know, we grew up.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that it's a good thing to say, hey, after that first date, I'll pay this time. The second date, if there is a second date, you know, you can go ahead and pay it if you would like that.
All right. Mike, I appreciate the call. That's Mike in Burbank. And Jordan in Studio City says, I'm pretty old school. I feel like I should pay, especially if I set up the date. Jordan is male, by the way. But I like it when my date reaches for her purse. The offering to pay is important. Then, once we go down the line, we can pay each other's way. That's Jordan in Studio City. I want to thank our guest, Carrie Cronin, who lectures college students about dating. That sounds so formal, lectures them. Speaks to them about Carrie, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
For having me. me.
Carrie Cronin, lectures at Boston College, among other institutions across the country. You can share your comments about who pays for that first or second restaurant date, kpcc.org. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later this hour, we're going to take a look at the first FDA-approved birth control app. We'll talk about how it works and the pros and cons of its use. Also, what can your boss access of your personal information on a computer that your employer has provided to you? There are limits in California. We'll talk about that as a major lawsuit filed takes aim at a company that actually went into a person's computer at their house and searched throughout it. But right now we turn our attention to California's first 6 months of its testing protocol for cannabis products. According to an Associated Press analysis of state data, nearly 20% of marijuana products in California that were tested failed for potency labeling and purity. That's a failure rate that some in the industry say is a result of unrealistic standards and technical glitches. Now, the check for testing began July 1st. There are still inventories of cannabis products from before that date that can be sold off. But the challenge has been particularly with other products that are made with cannabis, aside from the buds themselves. We're talking about edibles, tinctures. About a third of those were blocked from sale after they failed the testing. Now, one of the big challenges is in the THC levels of different concentrates or edibles. Trying to hit within 10% of what's advertised on the label has proven to be very, very difficult. There also isn't a way to challenge the result and have it change so that you can then turn around and sell the product. With us to talk about the challenges involved, the president of the United Cannabis Business Association, which is based in Los Angeles, Jared Kylo, who's the owner of the Higher Path Collective Insurance. Sherman Oaks. Jared, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Larry, for having me.
So share with us the challenge. You know, why in your view are so many of these products have a tough time passing?
I think because some of the labs don't really have a really concrete standing operating procedure about how to test each one of these individual products. There's variations even throughout the labs, internal and external to individual labs, that kind of give this kind of room for margin of error. And since the margin of error has been left at this 10% mark, I think that's a standard that's really hard to kind of meet in this kind of emerging industry and an emerging market of testing these kind of products.
So what would you be, if you think 10% is too rigid a standard, what should be the error rate between the label and what's in the product?
I think if we're looking at like maybe a 20 to 25% range to start as we transition not only the growers and the manufacturers and the vendors who are selling the products as they transition into the testing, but also as the labs come online and they start to become very aware and deal with their efficiencies and standard operating procedures, there's a transitional time that I think we really need to make sure that all these products make it to market. No one's died from cannabis yet, so we're still maybe swinging the pendulum a little bit too far in the regulatory sense, where these margins of error are a little too small, especially since we don't have a big problem with health concerns at this moment.
So I thought there had been some deaths in edibles. That's not the case?
Well, you might find them with other extenuating factors that go into it. We have not seen a case where THC or one of the cannabinoids was the reason for the death.
Okay. Also, I wanted to ask you about in the Associated Press piece, a company in Santa Ana, which does testing, Canalysis, said that they think that there needs to be an expansion of the testing of mold and yeast, that they saw samples where mold was on cannabis, but it still passed the test because that it wasn't required that it be tested for that, and it could still pose a potential health risk. What do you think about that?
Well, depending on which product it's in, if you're looking at the flower or buds, you're taking stuff above 500 degrees to burn it and ignite it. And a lot of these molds are completely dissipating at that kind of temperature. Most molds die at a particular temperature. So I think in some cases, the flower is something that could be easily remedied if we kind of use the incendiary side of it to be a standard. When you start looking at edibles, you start looking at other agricultural or ingestible goods that have particular standards on them for pests and molds. And so we kind of have to look towards those standards and our own agricultural needs to be the standards that we use for edibles and the vending side of things. I think we're moving a little bit too far and swinging a little bit too far for an emerging industry as cannabis is.
We're talking with Jared Kylo. He is the owner of the Higher Path Collective in Sherman Oaks, which provides cannabis both medical under prescription and recreationally. He's the president of United Cannabis Business Association in Los Angeles. Jared, are all your members legal, regulated cannabis stores?
Yes, that's the foundation of where a lot of our organization got together, is to make sure that the licensed and regulated retailers and distributors in the state had an opportunity to communicate with each other and make sure that we held our own internal standards, and then made sure that those good internal standards were known by the state so they could be a part of our regulation. So yes, everyone in our organization is a licensed retailer and or distributor.
It'd be interesting also to look at the percentages of the products and the reasons behind why they failed. Again, according to the AP analysis of the state data, it found that inaccurate labeling of THC content accounted for 2/3 of those failures. And then about 400 of the batches had unacceptable levels of pesticides. 114 of the products were rejected because of bacteria or mold. Said of the buds, it was less of a problem as the edibles. 90% of the buds tested were able to pass and to go on to shops, but there was a double rate of failure for oils and waxes. 20% of those did not make the cut. My question for you as an AirTalk listener is, if you are a cannabis user, do you think that a 10% standard of accuracy for THC is a good standard, or as some of the growers and sellers are arguing, should that be a less stringent standard? Would being within 20% of accuracy for THC labeling, would that be sufficient for you as a consumer? 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Christy Noblick-Palmer, who's co-founder of Kiva Confections, which manufactures cannabis-infused edibles. Christy's also the president of the California Cannabis Industry Association. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts about the failure rate for the testing? And first, are you surprised by it?
I'm not surprised by the failure rate when it comes to testing for a couple of reasons. So many folks have compared what's going on in the industry right now to building the plane as you're flying it. And so we are both implementing regulations, licensing businesses, and trying to keep products on the shelves all at the same time. So no, I don't find the failure rate surprising, although it's extremely concerning for those of us who are licensed businesses, and also very concerning for patients and new consumers.
All right. And what about the costs of this? Because obviously regulated cannabis businesses are competing with underground cannabis sales. And so what's the challenge in terms of the costs of the tests?
Sure. So as you mentioned, that 10% variance on potency is resulting in lots of failures of products. So that means those products have to be destroyed. And so you can imagine what that does to the bottom line of a manufacturing company. So we're seeing pretty intense costs in inventory that has to be thrown away or destroyed. We're also seeing, because of those failures, increases in the amount of inventory we have to keep on hand. Also, because products have to be destroyed, they're tested at the distributor level. So the manufacturer actually doesn't do its own testing. Those products are sent to a third party, a distributor, who then performs the test. And so what you have to do is fill that pipeline with product to sell. And as this industry is scaling, we're having to fill that pipeline with more and more products. And inventory equals cash. And we're in an industry where cash is hard to come by, right? We can't just go to a bank and get an existing line of credit or something like that. So there's some pretty intensive costs, many of which the illicit or illegal operators don't have to take on. No cost of compliance, no cost of testing, and no taxes.
And this, of course, is the challenge with legalization of recreational cannabis altogether, because there are inherently higher costs with something that is regulated. And so then the question is, how much are consumers and what percentage of those consumers are willing to pay the extra for something that's certified and that they know doesn't have, you know, fentanyl or who knows what that's added to it, to have that cleaner product? And Christy, what's your sense of that ultimately?
Yeah, so there have been some studies published that have said that consumers are willing to pay up to about 20% for regulated products that they know are safe and that they can trust. But right now, with taxes and the cost of compliance, we're seeing products more at 45 to 50% increase in cost. So we've crossed over that threshold to where the consumer is going to tolerate those types of products. State law also allows collective or unlicensed businesses to sell to consumers until the beginning of next year. So as a licensed business, both myself and Jared, we are competing against those products that are allowed to exist until the beginning of next year.
All right. Let's talk with Celia in West Covina. You're on Air Talk.
Hi there. I work for a medical marijuana delivery company. Up until January 1st, we were legal, but now there are very few cities that want to license us. We try so hard to be compliant, but it's not feasible for a small company. It's feasible for the large, large companies like Tiba. They've been around forever, and we wish we could carry them. But because we can't get licensing within a city, it is becoming impossible, and the black market is thriving. They are.
Okay. Hey, Celia, we're talking about testing those specifically, not licensing in this segment. So do you have something on licensing you wanted to say?
Licensing? Testing,
I'm sorry. Pardon me, testing.
I'm sorry.
Testing was what I meant. I'm sorry. Because the segment's about testing, not about licensing. Was there something on testing you wanted to bring up?
We're hearing each test is $1,000 a test, and we do test the products that we manufacture, and they're coming up good. But at $1,000 a pop, that is impossible for little people to come up with.
And so, Jared Kylo, you know, this was all in the push to legalize recreational cannabis. Why weren't we as voters hearing about this? Well, you know, that businesses can't afford to do the testing. Why was this not part of the debate?
I think because we didn't see the costs were going to rise this much. When you have a small number, I think we only have 33 licensed labs in the state of California. You know, there's a contraction there, and that contraction is that there's a bottleneck right at the testing side of it. So you can have 3 weeks to 3 months be the timeline it takes to get a product tested. And when you're as a lab and you have that kind of demand, well, you also have that kind of ability to charge these costs. And I don't think those costs were really recognized by the industry until at the final bit of when you finally see a lab say, this is what it's going to cost to be compliant with state regulations, and it's going to be close to $1,000. I think that was shocking to everyone.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us, laying out the challenge in complying with the testing standards for cannabis in California. That's Jared Kylo, President, United Cannabis Business Association, and Christy Noblick-Palmer, co-founder of Kiva Confections, President of the California Cannabis Industry Association. Coming up on Air Talk, we'll focus on what's going on in the world of employment law. When it comes to a computer issued by a company or paid for by a company, there's a big test case that's coming up on that. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. As you've been hearing all morning, Terry Gross with Bob Woodward about his new book, Fear, that comes up later on KPCC right after Air Talk at noon. An ex-managing director is accusing his former investment firm of hacking into his home computer to read his personal emails and obtain data stored on his hard drives that he himself purchased. But the desktop computer was paid for by his employer, Brevet Capital Management. Lawsuit was filed last week in Manhattan federal court alleging that Brevet violated federal anti-hacking laws. The company denies breaking the law. It said it was authorized to access plaintiff's home computer since it was their property. So the law sheds some light on what constitutes a work device. The question is, if your employer pays for, buys you a laptop or a desktop, do they then have the right to do a complete search of what's on your computer? Joining us is Wall Street Journal courts and legal reporter Nicole Hong, who's been writing about this case. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a bit more details on this case. Why does the company say that it even did this on the home-based computer of the plaintiff?
So the company's position is that they purchased this computer for the plaintiff, he's named Paul, because they wanted to give him a way to work from home. And he did do that. But the computer was also used as his family computer. His kids used it, his wife used it, et cetera. So we're wading into some kind of tricky gray areas involving a device that contains both personal and work material. And adding another layer to that, he had these personal hard drives that were plugged into the work computer,
which he purchased.
Yes. And to me, that's the more interesting legal question, which is, even if you decide that this is a work device because work paid for it, what do you do about personal devices that are plugged into that? Does that give employers the authorization to go in and look at all those materials? I think it's something that, at least based on the reader emails I'm getting, a lot of employees around the country are wondering.
Yeah. And there's also the issue of his personal email. And I read your article a couple days ago. I seem to recall the company denied going into his personal email. Is that correct? But he believes they did?
The language they used was very specific. They denied logging into his email. And
okay.
What he's alleging is that while he had his personal email pulled up, they were monitoring that and taking a look, essentially. So that also gets into some very tricky legal areas. You know, I've talked to some employment lawyers who have said, you know, if an employee saves his personal email login credentials on a work computer, does that give the employer authorization to just click login and see what's on the personal email? I'm not sure that that's a clear-cut example either.
Yeah, I'm just so curious. You know, when I'm sitting in the studio preparing for the program, I'll often open up my personal email. I don't think anything of it, and there's nothing on there that I would be concerned about. But just the principle of that, it never occurred to me that the employer would have the right to do it. But I guess the argument would be the employer owns the hardware, so, you know, why shouldn't they have the right?
Yeah, and especially in this example, the company in their handbook has really, really broad language saying they can monitor or view anything that is stored or processed on their servers. And one thing I learned from talking to employment lawyers that I didn't know before is that when you're accessing any personal data on a work computer, like your personal Gmail, a lot of those artifacts will stay on the computer, and the employer can hire forensics experts to essentially find the digital trail and figure out what you were doing and what you were looking at, even if they're not necessarily logging into your email account.
That's absolutely fascinating. So this has been filed in what branch of the court system?
It's Manhattan Federal Court.
Okay. Nicole Hong, the Wall Street Journal Courts and Legal reported following this fascinating case involving Paul Iacovacci, who is suing his former employer for accessing the desktop computer that his former employer had provided to him to use at home. Also with us is cybersecurity attorney Fred Jennings. He's based in New York and specializes in digital privacy. Fred, thank you for being with us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So what are the areas you think are still kind of gray here under the law?
So it's an interesting case for a lot of reasons. Like Nicole was saying, you've got not only the question of who owns and sort of has the right to control and access this laptop, which is itself a really fact-intensive, complex question. You've also got this other data on external hard drives. You've got personal email. You know, there's a lot of moving parts technically to what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. And what's your sense specifically of the personal email issue? Does that fall into a different category or not?
It does a little bit. This is one of those areas where most states don't have any specific law on it. I believe it's Delaware and Connecticut are the only two that I'm aware of that have sort of specific statutes covering employer access or monitoring of employee personal email on a work device. But the issue is that even if the handbook says we can monitor anything that happens on company servers, a personal email login is obviously not on those servers unless you're going through, say, a company network. If you're working from home on a sort of direct internet connection, your computer is talking to the email services servers, not the companies. And, you know, I think absent some very extreme language in something like an employee handbook or a contract, it's hard for me to think of a situation where the company would be permitted to full-on log in to a personal email service.
Now, of course, they may settle this lawsuit. It might not ever go to trial. But are you somewhat hopeful that it might actually get litigated to provide some more clarity?
It's like you say, it's fairly rare for these types of lawsuits to actually make it all the way to trial. But one thing that goes into a lot of that kind of, let's say, pretrial calculus about whether something goes forward or not or whether it settles is how complicated the fact and legal issues involved are. And, you know, this is an area where the law isn't particularly clear. It's very rare for contracts or handbooks to be perfectly unambiguous on, you know, all of the different potential issues here. So, you know, I'll be surprised a little bit if it doesn't go forward, at least to, say, motions to dismiss or to a summary judgment stage even. I think there's a lot here that we won't really I think the parties will have a hard time knowing until you've got exchange of discovery and kind of knowledge of the exact facts in the case.
We're talking with an attorney who specializes in cybersecurity law, Fred Jennings. Also with us, John Hyman, who focuses on labor law. Thank you very much, John, for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Under California law, are there any specific differences, protections that might apply here?
Not specifically. California's Constitution has a specific right of privacy built in under which an employee may be able to claim that an employer viewing the employee's kind of personal email, whether it's on the employee's own device or even on the employer's device, if there's not a legitimate business purpose for the employer to review that email or other kind of employee-owned data, might violate the employee's right of privacy as protected by California's state constitution. But that would be one specific protection that California would provide that other states or federal law does not.
In this case, the company alleges that the plaintiff, Mr. Iacovacci, was attempting to take information from the company, proprietary information, and use that to open up a competing company. He denies that. But Does the reason behind or the alleged reason for the company doing this to search his computer, does that factor in at all?
Yeah, it might. It would certainly give the employer a legitimate interest in conducting the search, but there's certainly accepted ways to do it where you're not going to, for example, hack into an employee's computer. There's a federal law called the Stored Communications Act that's, for example, going to protect an employee's personal email to the extent that email is stored on an outside server. So, for example, you have an employee uses a work-provided device to access his work email, but then also to access his personal Gmail, for example. Even though it's on the work device, unless the employee provides specific authorization, an employer's not entitled, even if the login and password is stored on that work device, is not entitled just to use that stored login and password to go into that employee's personal Gmail account. And I see this all the time in litigation where, an employee is going out to compete, and you get things like the employee is going to email himself proprietary confidential information to his or her own personal Gmail account. And then we get into questions of, well, how do we get this information? And the way you get it is through kind of valid court process and through discovery or through subpoenas or whatnot. The wrong way to do it and what gets employers in trouble is when they use, these stored logins or passwords to go and access the employee's information themselves, because now you violated this kind of federal hacking statute, the Stored Communications
Act. I also wanted to ask about something that may add a further layer of complication. If I'm not mistaken, it's not unusual for companies now to allow employees to use their own devices that they purchase, their own smartphones. But companies, if they're using it a lot for work, may give them monthly credit toward the cost of the phone. That, for example, does that then open up the door for the company to potentially access a personal smartphone?
Potentially, though, again, it depends on, a lot of this is going to come down to policy and what the employee has actually authorized. There's a case I know of in my home jurisdiction here in Ohio where a company gave an employee a BlackBerry to use for work. The company allowed the employee to use the BlackBerry for personal reasons. The employee put his own Gmail account on the BlackBerry device. Employee leaves, employer thinks employee is out, violating a non-compete agreement, stealing trade secrets, what have you, and then the company goes into that employee's BlackBerry and pulls up the employee's personal Gmail to determine whether or not there was some illegal activity going on. The employer argued that giving the employee the device and the employer paying for the device gave the employer specific authorization or implied authorization to access everything on that device, business or personal. And the court in that case actually disagreed with the employer and said, no, what's private is private. You had no authorization to go in and take a look at the employee's personal email on that device, and found that the employer had violated the Stored Communications Act. The statute requires specific authorization by the individual for an employer to go in and get the employee's personal data. And so without that specific authorization, whether it's the employee's computer, an employer-provided computer, or a mobile device, it's not going to matter. If the information is stored
on
some third-party server, the law is going to protect
it. Yeah, I want to thank you all. Such a fascinating case first came to my attention from Nicole Hong's piece in the Wall Street Journal. Nicole, thank you so much for elaborating on it and sharing with us this fascinating legal case. My thanks to attorneys Fred Jennings, who's the Cybersecurity Authority, John Hymond, labor law, employment law, his specialty. Coming up, we'll talk about the first FDA-approved birth control app. How does it work? What are its limitations? We'll find out about that after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Coming up, Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Bob Woodward on the day of publication of his new book, Fear, which has been getting so much attention over the past week. You'll hear from the author himself in just a few minutes here on 89.3. In a historic move, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved its first birth control app. That's right, a contraceptive app. Natural Cycle was developed in Switzerland, and how the app works is that it tracks the user's basal body temperature in order to determine her fertility levels on a given day. So the app then would tell you whether you're fertile or not. At least that's the theory behind it. The app's website says its users number at over 900,000. And that it has an effectiveness rate of 93%. We're going to talk about the pros and cons of using an app like this, as well as the privacy issues of the data that's collected as the user logs in on the basal temperature. With us is Jen King, a director of consumer privacy at Stanford's Center for the Internet and Society. Thank you so much, Professor King, for joining us.
Thank you.
What are your privacy concerns, if any, about this app, which relies on this personal data?
Looking at this app in particular, I actually don't think it's as bad as other players in that market. For one thing, they do benefit from being in Europe. I believe they're out of
Switzerland, I believe.
It's actually Sweden.
Sweden, I'm sorry.
They're subject to the European data protection regulations, which are definitely a lot stronger than what we have here in the U.S.
So you feel like this is fairly safe. What are your concerns about some of the other apps that are in this same space?
So the data you collect with these apps can be very personal. At least they usually have your email address, and you can elect to give them a lot more information about you personally, such as your menstrual cycle, as well as information about how often you've had intercourse. So that's, you know, fairly sensitive data that most people probably wouldn't want disclosed out of potentially a doctor-patient relationship. And I think one of the things that users really need to be aware of is that in the U.S., these apps are not subject to health privacy laws because it's not an actual relationship you have with a doctor.
Interesting.
It's made by literally anybody. So I could create an app tomorrow that tracked fertility, and as long as I got people to adopt it, I could collect data about them.
So in the case of Natural Cycles, you said it was developed in Europe, so you think that there are more privacy protections. But it sounds like the company wouldn't have to adhere to that legally for U.S. clients.
No. Right. So to some extent, we're relying on the fact that when the Europeans gather data, they're mostly following their own rules, and that we have to hope they grandfather us in, essentially.
All right. Jen King of Stanford's Center for Internet and Society. She directs the Consumer Privacy Program there. Also with us is adjunct professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine. She's the lead author of a study on the accuracy and efficacy of birth control apps, Marguerite Duane. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you see as the range of accuracy, and maybe this FDA-approved one specifically? Do you see it as highly accurate?
So FACTS, the Fertility Appreciation Collaborative to Teach the Science, an organization which I lead, did a study of fertility awareness apps that was published in 2016. And we looked at all the apps that were available on the market as of 2015, and at that time, there were almost 100 apps on the market. We only ended up reviewing about 40 of them because the majority of fertility awareness apps are actually not based on any evidence-based fertility awareness method, meaning they're tracking data, women are recording information, but the app was not following any specific evidence-based guidelines in terms of helping women predict their fertile window. A number of these apps also had disclaimers saying that they should not be used to avoid pregnancy. Sometimes that disclaimer was buried down deep.
Well, then what's the point of using it?
Exactly. Well, some women like to use the app because it's an easy way to track their signs. It's a nice tool for them to record their information. We encourage women, if you are interested in using a fertility awareness-based method, to learn a method from a trained instructor, to learn to observe your signs of fertility. Women can learn to observe cervical fluid secretions, as well as their basal body temperature and or urinary hormone measurements. And by learning one of the evidence-based FABMs, women can identify when they're fertile and when they're not. And the app can serve as a tool to help them track those signs and symptoms.
All right. And what are the limitations of the basal temperature?
So great question. The Natural Cycles app uses tracking of basal body temperature in combination with an algorithm to help women identify the fertile window. The basal body temperature actually is a sign when the basal body temperature rises, it's a sign that a woman has ovulated. So it's a good marker to tell you when ovulation has occurred and when you're entering into an infertile period. But it does not tell you when your fertile window is opening. So when we did a review of the apps, at the time, Natural Cycles did not rate highly in our review because it was based on a proprietary algorithm, and at that time, they had not done any studies of effectiveness of their method. It's our understanding that they use data to estimate the beginning of the woman's fertile window in combination with the basal body temperature to determine the end. So the app may be much more effective for couples who are using it to prevent pregnancy if they solely use it to identify after their fertility has passed, what we call the luteal phase or post-ovulatory phase. But prior to ovulation, the app may not be as effective because it's really relying on data calculations, and a woman's cycle may vary depending on stress or other factors. So the app in and of itself may be helpful to some women. I will say it's good that it's actually drawing more attention to the field of fertility awareness because women are interested in looking for effective hormone and side effect-free forms of family planning. So it's good that it's opening up the conversation, but I really think we have to be careful and look at the science.
We're talking with Marguerite Duane of Georgetown University School of Medicine, who led the study that she was just describing, looking at different apps that serve as birth control that enable women to be able to track their fertility cycles. Also with us, Director of Gynecology at UC Davis School of Medicine and Medical Center, Clara Paik. Dr. Paik, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I was looking at the FDA's release on Natural Cycles in which it described the approval, and it said this about the study, that the clinical trial involved more than 15,500 women. They used the app for an average of 8 months, and for those who had what's called perfect use, that they were the most compliant with it, they had a failure rate of under 2%, and that included women who were, during the period when they knew they were fertile, were using birth control that failed. That's included in the 1.8% failure rate. That sounds pretty positive. What do you make of that?
Well, the only problem with using perfect use failure rate is that that is not going to be a typical failure rate in the general population. So it's kind of a way to market the device, but I do think that you have to be cautious because most women are not going to be using it perfectly, and that means really having quite a predictable cycle, which many women do not have, and also doing the basal body temperatures correctly. That includes using a basal body temperature thermometer, which is different from a regular thermometer. It's way more sensitive to the temperature. You have to do it in the morning without having, hopefully drunk any coffee or gone to the restroom. So there are a lot of things that goes into perfect use, and I don't think we can assume that most women are going to use the device this way.
Dr. Peck, I also understand that the basal body temperature needs to be taken at the same time every morning, which could be a challenge because if the user is getting up earlier on work days, sleeping in on the weekend, it's not going to be the same time.
That is absolutely correct. And that is the reason why I think that there are going to be failures if you open this device or use it for the general population or market it in general to say that there's that this is a great contraceptive method, is that you really do have to take into consideration that taking a basal body temperature every morning at about the same time to get the most accurate basal body temperature of a woman is going to be really pretty difficult. And I do think that even with the calculation of the 6.5% failure rate with the typical use of the app, that may not be completely accurate given that when we reviewed the study at our UC Davis Journal Club and wrote an editorial to contraception that was by Dr. Schimmeler and Dr. Krennan, typical use user, the failure rate may not have been calculated completely accurately because they had to only use the women, they only calculated that failure rate for the women who are using the device at the end of the study, and that was a year-long follow-up, and about 54% of women were not using the app at that.
They dropped out.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. How do you join your journal club? That sounds interesting.
We have a UC-wide journal club that UC Davis participates in, and it's run by our family planning division. Dr. Mitchell Krennan is the director of family planning here at UC Davis.
Sounds interesting. Look at all those different published articles. Clara Peck with us, directs gynecology, UC Davis Medical Center. Dr. Peck is a practicing gynecologist and trains OBGYN residents at UC Davis. Marguerite Duane at Georgetown University School of Medicine with us as well, who has studied these birth control apps. And Jen King from Stanford University Center for Internet Society. I'm sorry we couldn't get higher profile guests for our conversation here. We'll continue with your calls. I'd love to hear from you if you have used a birth control app. What are the pros and cons of it? I'd like to hear your thoughts about it. What do you see as the limitations? 866-893-KPCC. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. We're just a few minutes away from Terry Gross' Fresh Air. Bob Woodward, his new book, Fear, is the subject for Terry today. Stay tuned. That's coming right up. Right now, we're talking about the first birth control app approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. And we're talking with three experts to share their views on what they see as the pros, the cons, the limitations. Marguerite Duane of Georgetown University, Jen King of Stanford University, and Clara Peck of UC Davis. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you've used one of these apps, including Natural Cycles, which is the one FDA approved now, I'd like to hear your experience with it, what you think about it. 866-893-KPECC. Bonnie in Santa Monica, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, yeah, I am a big fan of these apps. I feel like it really allows women to take control of their own bodies, really. You learn your cycle, and instead of just, I was saying, like 90% of women I know, I think, have been on hormone birth control since we were very, very young, and they have really crazy side effects sometimes. And you know, a lot of us have moved over to using these apps and have had really positive experiences, just feeling more in charge of our cycles or our bodies or our fertility.
Bonnie, do you rely on an app exclusively for birth control?
I did, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you didn't have an unplanned pregnancy. You found it was successful?
I did find it was successful, and it was kind of an amazing experience to learn about my cycle for the first time. It's not something that anybody teaches you
in school, or at least the school that I went to.
Did you have any trouble with compliance, making sure that, you know, every day you used it as directed?
See, I didn't even use one that I had to take my temperature. I just tracked my cycle, and luckily I know that I'm lucky in that my cycle is pretty regular.
Okay.
But for me, it was getting to know my own body. Oh, yeah, I can tell this is what I'm ovulating or whatnot.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Marguerite Duane of Georgetown was just talking about. John, Bonnie, I appreciate your call. Professor Duane, you want to comment on that?
Sure. No, I think she highlights a great point in why it, not only the ask, but why fertility awareness-based methods are very interesting to women, because it actually educates women about their cycle, and it really empowers them with information about where they are in their cycle and what to expect. And again, basal body temperature is just one of the signs that women can learn to track. They can also learn to track cervical fluid, which can be very helpful in helping them to understand when they're entering their fertile window and when they're not. And, you know, it's not only useful, these are true family planning methods, because couples can use them to avoid pregnancy, but they can also use the methods to help achieve pregnancy. And I work with many single women who use these methods to help better manage and monitor their PMS symptoms, for example. So the broader applications of fertility awareness-based methods as a whole are quite impressive. But again, I would emphasize, you know, not to place too much emphasis in the technology, but encourage women to actually learn from trained instructors how to chart their cycle and how to interpret this information. Because if you make a mistake or you forget to track, as Dr. Paik pointed out, I mean, that can result in an unintended pregnancy or consequences that you were not hoping for. So technology is great.
Yeah.
I like to say women are smart. They're smarter than their smartphones, so they should learn for themselves to truly be able to interpret and understand the signs that their body is showing them.
It's Marguerite Duane of Georgetown University School of Medicine. Melissa and Laverne said, I used apps to attempt to plan both of my pregnancies, but they didn't work well for me because my cycle isn't regular. That's Melissa in Laverne. Let me go back to Dr. Clara Paik, Director of Gynecology, UC Davis Medical Center. How would you compare the efficacy of an app like Natural Cycles with other forms of birth control?
Yes. Well, typical use of the app was supposedly about 6 to 7%. But remember, we discussed that that might not be completely accurate because we don't have a lot of information on those patients in the study. Typical use birth control pills, meaning if a woman is generally taking the pills, it can be anywhere from 3 to 9% failure rate. The best forms of contraception are the long-acting devices like the IUD and the implant. Typical fertility awareness-based methods in certain studies have been about 20 to 25% failure rate. So we, I think that women just need to be counseled about all of the different options and to find a method that's best for them. I think it's great that the young lady discussed that she learned more about her cycles. I think education about your own cycles, I think, is a great idea. But we have to be careful that women will have intercourse outside of that non-fertile days, and you have to be really careful.
I want to thank you all so much. That's Dr. Clara Paik, UC Davis, Marguerite Duane, Georgetown University, Jen King, Stanford University. She directs their consumer privacy program at the Center for Internet and Society. From all of us at Air Talk, have a wonderful afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10.